Good evening, everyone. It's really great to be here. I thank Bob and I thank Josh and the church for having me and all the groups that co-sponsored this evening's event. I'm very grateful to you. It's quite an honor to be here. I've only been to Seattle once before, right after 9/11, so it's always good to go into some area where I really haven't been before and meet some new people. I live in Brunswick, Maine. Been there about 2 years, and before that I lived for 30 years in Florida. You know, it's one thing to have a Bush for president, but when you have a Bush for president and a Bush for governor, it's just too much. You know what I mean? I'm going to start out with a little bit about myself. I think it's always interesting to know a little bit about your speaker. I grew up in a military family, Air Force family, and we moved around the world. And in 1968, we were living in the panhandle of Florida. It's so conservative there, they call it Lower Alabama. And I had my first organizing experience in 68, working on the Nixon campaign for president. I was a vice chair of the Okaloosa County Florida Young Republican Club. And I did such a good job on the campaign that right before the election, they had a fish fry fundraiser for Nixon. And they asked me to sit at the head table with their guest speaker that evening. You probably heard of the guy. He died a couple years ago, Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. So that's how I got my start in politics. And from there, it went downhill. In 1971, I tried to join the Air Force. By this time, we had moved to California. And I reported to the Oakland Induction Center to take my physical, and I flunked my physical because of an old high school football injury. And so when everybody else was trying to get out of the military because of the war in Vietnam, people with good sense, I was trying to get in. So I want to read to you, if I might, from my new book, just a little bit about my first experiences in joining the military. I had to report for my induction physical at the Oakland, California Center. Long lines of new recruits stood outside, waiting for the doors to open. A middle-aged woman was working the line, pleading with each of us not to go into the military. Her son had been killed in Vietnam, she wailed. Her mournful cries cut right through to my gut and were followed by more appeals from a black man who had no face, no ears, nose, just holes in his head, surrounded by a burnt, scarred face. That told us more about the horror in Southeast Asia. And so after my basic training and my job training, I was sent to my permanent base, Travis Air Force Base in Northern California. It was an airlift base for the war in Vietnam. GIs from all over America would come there to get on the planes to go to Vietnam, and when the planes would come back, they would bring the body bags of the dead soldiers. So I reported to Travis Air Force Base for permanent duty. I checked into the orderly room, the office in the barracks that makes room assignments and keeps a lid on barracks life. It was mid-1971. The clerk in the orderly room ran his finger down the long room list and shook his head. "Man, I only got one room left," he said, "but we'll get you out of there as soon as we can. Grab your bags," he told me, "and follow me down the hall. Long, dark hallway, last door on the left." And he kept apologizing to me over and over again, and I thought it would be a little broom closet with a cot in it, and I'd stay there a couple nights. But then he opened the door and we went in. Anti-war posters were all over the wall. A refrigerator, against barracks rules, of course, painted an ugly dark blue, sat in the corner. They had put me in with the leading anti-war organizer in the barracks. They were trying to keep him isolated, and as they attempted to build a case against him to kick him out. "Get that cot, man," he said, and as he apologized to me again, leaving me in my new world. A couple of nights a week, there would be a knock on the door, and white GIs would come in with chairs and arrange them in circles, light up joints, And they would begin talking about the Vietnam War. I sat in a corner in sheer terror, thinking, these must be communists, pot smokers, cursing our government and our President Nixon. I didn't know what to do, but I stayed there and I listened. Another night, there was a knock on the door, which revealed black GIs from the cities, members of the Black Panthers, talking about racism. It didn't take me long to inch my chair into the circle in my new barracks room. The things the GIs were saying, even though much of it was new to me, made sense. I began reading their books, and I began smoking their pot, although I want to go on record officially that I never, ever inhaled. But after about 6 to 9 months, my world turned upside down. I decided I was a conscientious objector and needed to get out. And I went to the military and told them that I'd like to be released. And their first question to me was, what's your family history? Do you come from a traditional peace church, Quaker, Brethren, Mennonite? No, I'm a young Republican from a military family. And so they turned me down. And I didn't know enough at the time to know that there were other options available to me. So I ended up doing 3.5 years of what I called hard time. Because after I figured out what was going on, it was real hard for me to stay in the military. And then what finished me off was reading the Pentagon Papers, the government's own secret history, released by the great man Daniel Ellsberg, who had the courage to release these to the New York Times, that told the story of the government's own fabrication of the pretext to drag us into the war in Vietnam. And this shattered all remaining illusions of this young patriotic military boy who grew up with the pictures of all the planes on the flight line on my bedroom wall, and who spent his time reading the We Were There series of books. We were there at Lexington, Concord. We were there at the Alamo. We were there at the Battle of the Bulge. And so I felt betrayed by my government. So after I finally got out, I was going to college at the University of Florida, just ready to graduate, when I got recruited by the United Farm Workers Union to become an organizer of fruit pickers in Florida for Cesar Chavez's union. And I quit college, never to return, to become a professional organizer, and I've been doing it ever since. And for 15 years, I was the state coordinator of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, a multi-issue organization. And in that job, we began to analyze the space program. And I began taking people over and over again out to the Space Center for protests, talking about how the military had taken over the space program. But tonight I want to talk to you about the battle for America's soul. And in that context of that topic, I will talk about space, but I want to talk about space in the larger context of what they call today military transformation. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of War, his number one job today, even more important than the war in Iraq, is what they call military transformation. And so I want to talk to you about that tonight. But first, I want to kind of set the stage, if you will. I want to talk about America. And if I could be so brazen, I want to talk about the soul of America. I ask you to think of this nation as cloth. And think of the threads that wove this nation together. Good threads and bad threads. Dark threads and light threads. You know, the genocide of the native people from the earliest days. The introduction of slavery in America. Really bad, dark threads, if you will, into the cloth of America. But then the abolition movement and the women's suffrage movement and the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, more contemporary, positive, light threads, if you will, woven into the cloth of America. So that what I would submit to you is the cloth in and of itself is a conflicted cloth, sort of a schizophrenic cloth, a cloth that reflects a torn and conflicted soul of our nation today. Not black, not white, but many, many, many shades of gray. This is the soul, if I can be so bold, of America today. Let's go back to Valley Forge, that important moment in American history at the time of the revolution against the British Empire. And let's remember the huddled peasant army sitting around the fire at Valley Forge, freezing in the winter, hungry, ill-equipped, ill-armed to fight this great empire. And they were a bit mutinous at times, wondering if they would ever be paid and how could they ever win when they were so outnumbered and so outarmed. And remember George Washington riding in on his white horse, imploring the revolutionary peasant army to hang in there. We'll pay you when we win. Just bring us to victory. And the people did. They responded to the leadership of George Washington. And then the war was over, and a constitution was created. A constitution that said white men who own land can vote. And so many of the men huddled around the fire automatically could not vote because they were not landowners. They had been indentured servants. They were peasants in this army. They couldn't vote. But a few of them could vote. They, before the war, had little farms that had been left unattended because of the war. They hadn't harvested anything for some time. They were in debt as it was. They weren't paid when the war was over, but they went back to their farms trying to rebuild their lives, hang on to their farms, and to vote in this new democracy. But taxes were imposed, whiskey tax and other tax, and they went into rebellion. You might have heard about Shays' Rebellion in western Massachusetts, where they went into rebellion because they began to lose their land because they couldn't afford to pay the taxes. And then they couldn't vote in this new country, and they felt betrayed, and they said, wait a minute, what happened to that democracy we fought for? And Shays' Rebellion was quashed by Washington's army that was sent in, with them hanging many of these rebels against this new government in the streets to show the public that you will not stand against this. At this time of Valley Forge, the Continental Congress had been appropriating money to feed and clothe and arm these revolutionary soldiers, but the corporations, if you will, the weapons corporations of the time, were stealing and not delivering the goods. So there was corruption within the military-industrial complex at that early stage of the formation of the United States of America. Now fast forward to the 1860s, to the Dakotas, to the great Indian Wars. You've heard of Crazy Horse, one of the great leaders of the Lakota people. Remember, they had been given the sacred Pahasapa, what the Indians called the heart of the universe, the Black Hills. As long as the grass was to grow, they were given this entreaty that the white people would never take the Pahasapa because they were being pushed farther and farther west. But then gold was discovered in the Black Hills, and Custer was sent in to clear a path so the whites could move into the Black Hills to extract the gold there. And the Indians said, wait a minute, what about the treaty? And so the army was increased, and they were increasingly killing people in Lakota Nation. And slowly, over a period of 20 years, the native people were dragged onto the reservation there in South Dakota, in that region. Except for Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, their small bands held out, rebellious, for over 20 years. But they began to starve because the buffalo were disappearing, the deer and the antelope were disappearing, and they couldn't feed their people in the winter anymore. So slowly they too came onto the reservation against all better judgment, breaking their hearts, because their way of life was now over. And the deal was that they had to turn in to the government their horses and their guns. They couldn't even go hunting anymore. But they were promised they would be provided blankets and food for as long as the grass was green. But then very quickly they discovered that the blankets were so thin they wouldn't keep them warm in the winter. The bacon was rancid and the flour was full of bugs. And the Indians felt betrayed. The corporations that were hired by the Congress to supply the Indians on the reservations were stealing and giving inferior product to the Indians. And then the corporations discovered that, you know what, this peace is costing us a lot. The war, the Indian War, was so profitable for us. And so they created a public relations team and sent them out all over America to the big cities. And they did artist renditions of Crazy Horse and his band back on the warpath, killing innocent women and children. And this was in all the major papers across America. And so the public rose up in outrage. These Indians are killing white people. What is the government doing about it to protect the settlers? And so the Congress appropriated even more money to fight the Indian wars for the corporations as Crazy Horse sat in his tent on the reservation in South Dakota without a gun and a horse to his name. Corruption within the military-industrial complex from the very first days. And now today we go to Iraq, where Halliburton and Bechtel are receiving well over $6 billion of your hard-earned tax dollars every single month. And it's still not enough. And we're told we're going to be there a while. I saw Hillary Clinton and Senator Lindsey Graham, the new senator, Republican from South Carolina, came back from Iraq about a month ago. It was a Sunday morning. I'm watching that TV show on Sunday morning. You've probably seen it, called Phase the Nation. And Lindsey Graham says, you know, Hillary and I don't often agree on things, but we agree on one thing. We're going to be in Iraq a long time. And Hillary says, you know, the American people need to relax. We've been in Korea for 50 years. And you know what came to mind immediately? Those immortal words of George W. Bush right after 9/11. As we invaded Afghanistan, the American people had better be patient, he said. It's going to be a long, long war. And now today, after all that, after all the theft and corruption going on within the military-industrial complex, that's still not enough. The aerospace corporations, the weapons industry, has identified space as a new market, saying that Star Wars, the generic name for all of their plans to put warfare into the heavens, Star Wars, they say at the Pentagon, will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth, necessitating so much money. The industry, in an editorial in one of the publications I subscribe to called Space News, the industry said, you know, we are responsible citizens. We understand Star Wars is going to be expensive, and we know we have an obligation to come up with a funding source. And so we have. And we are now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure that funding source. And they said it is the entitlement programs that are officially defined as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got through with it. These are the programs that the military-industrial complex has now said their lobbyists will destroy in order to provide funds to create a new arms race in the heavens. I call it pyramids to the heavens. The aerospace industry are the new pharaohs of our age, building these pyramids to the heavens. And we, the taxpayers, will be the slaves. We'll turn over everything, social progress, in order that they can go and take control of space. So I would submit to you, fellow Americans, that we are all now the Indians. And we will all now be brought onto the reservation, if you get my drift. Some of you, most of you, probably have heard of this document put out by the United States Space Command, the Pentagon Command, in charge of developing all of this for space. On the back cover, they have the Earth sitting on a pedestal, and above it, it says, Space, the Warfighter's Edge. The Pentagon now brags that all warfare on the Earth today is coordinated by space technology. The recent shock and awe invasion of Iraq was totally coordinated by 50 satellites at various bases in Colorado. And in fact, the weapons that were used in the shock and awe invasion of Iraq, 70% of the weapons in that invasion were guided to their targets by space satellites, by space technology. So in this document, the Pentagon talks about how the United States, 5% of the world's population here in the United States, we must dominate space. We must control space. And they say we must develop an ability to deny others the use of space. Because the Pentagon understands that if the United States can utilize space to win the wars on the earth below, so could somebody else, right? And in fact, on their headquarters building at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, right over the front door, they have their logo that reads Master of Space. And in fact, they wear it as a patch on their uniform. So we will be the master of space by developing new offensive technologies, giving us control and domination of space. And again, whoever controls space becomes the Ubermeister of the planet below. Now, you've all heard, I'm sure, of this program called National Missile Defense, right? The rogue states are coming, and they want to attack the United States with weapons of mass destruction. And we, therefore, have to protect ourselves and have a bullet hit a bullet in deep space in order to protect the continental United States from attack by these rogue states. Missile defense. Iraq. As it turned out, Iraq had zero weapons of mass destruction. Iran. Today, as it turns out, Iran has zero weapons of mass destruction. North Korea. North Korea, as it turns out today, has zero weapons of mass destruction capable of hitting the continent of the United States. And now China is thrown into the equation. China, who admittedly has 22-0 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the west coast of the United States, while the United States of America has well over 7,000 nuclear weapons of our own, an arsenal of hypocrisy, I might suggest, as we lecture the rest of the world that you are not allowed to have weapons of mass destruction while we build new generations of them and Star Wars, not only the sword, but the shield as well. First strike, preemption. I would submit to you that national missile defense, some people say, you know, it won't work. The tests aren't working. Don't worry about it, Bruce. Why are you getting so worried? Well, number one, it's a waste of your money. $10 billion a year for research and development. Over $130 billion since World War II spent on Star Wars research and development. But I promise you that national missile defense is a Trojan horse. This whole thing doesn't have anything to do with defense. But they knew it was going to cost so much, they couldn't come to the American people and say, turn over the national treasury so we could be the master of space, so we could control and dominate and deny other countries access to space. So they had to do like they did during the days of the Lakotas and Sitting Bull. They had to create a PR campaign to sell the corruption to the American people. National missile defense. When it's all about offense. And Bush today is on Verge. New York Times 2 months ago or so, released a story saying Bush is on verge of announcing a new Pentagon space doctrine. Now, doctrine is a very important word. Doctrine is more than plan, more than vision, more than intention. Doctrine is implementation. And this new doctrine expected from Bush any moment is to give the green light to the Pentagon to go ahead with the early deployments of offensive systems in space, particularly anti-satellite weapons that would go up and destroy other countries' satellites. Elementary technology, they call it kinetic energy anti-satellite weapon, ASAT. Kinetic energy ASAT. Kinetic energy just means one thing smashing into another. A satellite's in a very predictable orbit. You identify it, you go up and you take it out. Do you remember on July 4th, the Comet Smasher? You know, NASA, they brag that every mission now, every civilian mission is dual use, meaning it's both military and civilian at the same time. Every one of these missions, they say, at NASA, because the military has taken over the space program. They're riding the horse. And so, is it possible to conceive that one of the jobs of the Comet Smasher mission was to identify an object in space and go up and collide with it? Anti-satellite weapon. In addition, the Bush administration is talking about this program called Rods from God. Tungsten steel rods deployed like on a satellite in space that would be dropped down to Earth, gathering enormous speed as they fell to Earth, and then be able to even hit underground bunkers, go underground. And then the successor to the shuttle. If you're listening real close, remember what the Indians said, put your ear to the railroad tracks and hear the train coming. If you're listening real close to the shuttle talk these days, you're hearing people say, you know, that shuttle is an outdated technology. We need to replace it with something new. And so they've already been working on that. The replacement is called the military space plane. Working on many derivatives of it today. And in fact, the Pentagon, the Space Command, has been wargaming a first strike preemptive attack on China the last several years. I've been reading about it in Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine. Set in the year 2016, the red team versus the blue team, the United States versus China. And in that war game, computer war game, the United States launches a preemptive first strike attack on China, and the first weapon that is used is the successor to the shuttle, the military space plane, outfitted with massive megatonnage of weapons, drops down from orbit, hits China in an attack, and goes back up again, something that the shuttle does not have the capability of doing today. Now, a few years ago, when I told this story, some of my friends would say, Bruce, you're getting paranoid in your old age. The United States, they talk a lot of stuff, but we would never do a preemptive first strike attack on anybody. But those days have changed, my dear friends. In addition, the Pentagon is working on a thing they like to call the Death Star, space-based laser. Orbiting battle stations, 25 to 40 of them, orbiting the Earth, firing lasers and hitting targets on the Earth below. But they say it's a problem. One of our board members, Dr. Michio Kaku, a renowned physicist, says that there's only really two ways to provide the enormous power to refuel a laser. After you fire it, it takes incredible power. You fire it, and then you have to refuel it. So there's two ways to do it. One is, he said, you could run an extension cord from down here on up to the laser. But one of you peaceniks would come and unplug it, right? He said the only other way to really successfully do it, and we've seen this in many different congressional and Pentagon documents, is nuclear reactors in space, orbiting battle stations powered with nuclear reactors. Imagine them having war in space with these and then inevitably tumbling back to Earth. You remember 2 years ago, the Columbia shuttle burning up on reentry, spreading its debris over Texas and Louisiana? Imagine nuclear reactors with uranium or plutonium-238 spreading deadly toxins over portions of the Earth to be ingested by the people into our lungs. And so today at NASA and the Department of Energy, they're working on Project Prometheus, the nuclear rocket, that they say will be used to get us out to Mars in half the time, because it will have nuclear reactors for engines. And we'll use to go and have moon bases so that we can control access on and off the planet Earth, because whoever controls the moon, the Earth-Moon gravity well, as it's called, will control who gets on and off the planet Earth. All of this is spelled out in our video, Arsenal of Hypocrisy, on the back table. So when you have Project Prometheus, the nuclear rocket, to go to Mars and the moon, what's the military dual use of Project Prometheus? I'm going to tell you another story that recently blew my mind and affected my whole organizing, my talks, everything that I do today. I was watching C-SPAN one evening, and they announced a program by Thomas Barnett, who I previously had heard of because he had written a book called The Pentagon's New Map. It was in a couple of the national magazines. And so I wanted to see it. It was a three-hour presentation. The audience was filled, huge room, with high-level military brass. And they also said, when they announced it, high-level CIA people. And so when he was introduced, Barnett was introduced as Donald Rumsfeld's strategy guy, helping Rumsfeld develop and articulate and teach the transformation that's underway today, military transformation. And at that time, Barnett was a professor at the Naval War College in Rhode Island. He's since left there because his books are doing so well. He's in such demand these days. And he told this story. He said, you know, there's a part of the world that is not yet submitting to corporate globalization. He called it the non-integrating gap. They're not going along with the show. And he said, he went on to describe it, this non-integrating gap is the Middle East, where today we're in Iraq with bases and building 14 enduring bases there. Central Asia, where we are today with bases in Afghanistan. Kyrgyzstan, where we just built a new Star Wars radar receiving downlink listening post in that country. You might have heard a month or so ago, 500 pro-democracy protesters were gunned down in the streets of Kyrgyzstan by their dictator. The United States didn't have much to say about it because we don't want to anger them because they've given us permission to build this Star Wars listening post on China's inland border as we begin an encirclement of China. We now have bases since 9/11, you know, in Central Asia, part of this non-integrating gap, throughout this region. Look at a map. We are now in places where we never could have gone during the Cold War. China's inland border, what used to be the southern border of the former Soviet Union, we would have gone to nuclear war with them if we had tried to put bases in there. That would have been like the Soviet Union trying to put nuclear missiles in Cuba during the 60s. But here we are today, since 9/11. 9/11 opened the door to a whole lot of new military transformation. Well, so Middle East, Central Asia, he says, Barnett says, Africa, where we will be fighting 20 years from now for their oil. And he says parts of Latin America, where you know there's oil in Venezuela, and Hugo Chavez is not doing the bidding of the U.S. oil corporations, and so we're now angry. We've already tried a coup on a couple of occasions to get him out of there. So this non-integrating gap must be brought in line. Now, Barnett went on to say, you know, in this new world order, because of corporate globalization, we're not going to have jobs in America anymore. Why pay somebody $20 an hour to make TVs in America when you can go over to China or other places and pay them a couple dollars a day? From a corporate standpoint, it doesn't make sense, right? Corporations don't care about country. They care about maximizing profits. And they'll do whatever they need to do it, right? And so we're not going to have jobs in America, he says. And so every country in the New World Order will have a new role. And so Barnett asks, what will our role be here in America? Security, export. Security, export. He said, we're not going to have the big bases in Europe anymore. We're going to close them down. We're now going to create new little lily pad bases, small, little, tiny, jumping off lily pad bases throughout the non-integrating gap. So anytime anyone stands up to the authority of corporate globalization, the United States military and this new transformed Pentagon will be able to intervene in lightning speed and go in and suppress any opposition to corporate globalization. Preemption. Preemption is the key because you can't wait till it gets out of hand. You got to go in preemptively. As soon as there's any sign at all that they're getting a little too frisky, you got to go in and take them out. And Barnett told the assembled room of officers and CIA people, forget international treaties, we're not going to have them anymore. That's why it's been so important for Bush to have John Bolton go to the UN, because his job is to walk into that building like a terrorist and throw a hand grenade and blow it up. Destroy the United Nations. We're not going to have international treaties anymore. He said everything is going to be preemption. And he told the audience, and this is a direct quote from the video that I've watched three times and I've taken explicit notes. You know, Hitler never had to ask for permission to invade anybody, and we don't either. Now, if any of the officers and CIA agents in the audience had any conscience, Barnett also took care of that. He told them, look, that if you hope to get promoted in the future, if you hope to rise in the military, then you will internalize this new military transformation, and you will go teach it to those under you. And we all know the stories coming out of the Pentagon. Those generals that warned that the planned invasion of Iraq was not going to work, and that the so-called peace afterwards was not going to work, that they da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They were let go. Remember that? Because they dared stand up to the plan. The plan that I believe, and this is just my opinion, was intended from the outset to be chaotic. Because had they, quote-unquote, been able to secure the peace in Iraq, then there'd be no justification for staying. My congressman, liberal Democrat Tom Allen from Maine, who said he was opposed to the war, continues to vote for money after money after money for the war. His position is, well, if we leave, there'll be a civil war in Iraq. We have to stay to secure the peace. And if it takes us a long time, as Hillary Clinton says, we've been in Korea for 50 years, she says. So the more chaotic it is there in Iraq, the more justification it is, even within the Democratic Party, that we have to stay, to stabilize, to bring these people peace. Because if we leave, there'll be a civil war. And so Barnett says, forget the old notions of Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. Everything, because of space technology, is net-centric now. All the military services are on the same plane. Whether you're in a tank, a boat, a plane, on the ground, carrying a gun, everything is coordinated by space technology, net-centric. We're not going to have the old divisions anymore. We're going to have two militaries, Barnett said. One he called Leviathan. Leviathan. Leviathan, he said, is give me your angry, young, 18, 19, 20-year-old men who love to play video games. And we're going to go in to the non-integrating gap and kick ass. Now, what this meant to me, my interpretation is, we're not going to have jobs in America anymore. And as the local tax base dries up because jobs move out of the country, education gets defunded, right? Along with a lot of other things. And so you're going to have a lot of 18, 19, 20-year-old angry young men who see no future, who have no hope. They drop out of school because there are no jobs left anymore. And so there's naturally, there's the economic draft. They're going to go into the military because there's no alternative for them, no future, especially poor kids and working class kids whose parents can't put them into college and keep them away from the military. Now, Barnett said, we've already shown with the invasion of Iraq that Leviathan was very successful. Nobody can stand up to it. They rolled over. They got out of the way. They ran for the hills. We went in. We took over. Leviathan at its best. But, he said, we're not doing the other part so good. And the other service will be what he called systems administration. SysAd. SysAd, Barnett said, will be the proconsul of the empire. They will go into an area after Leviathan secures it, and they will administer the empire. And these troops, he said, quote, will never come home, unquote. Remember what Hillary Clinton said. We've been in Korea for 50 years. These troops will never come home. So that is their vision. all tied together with space technology. You can see why space technology and the ability to deny other countries access to space, because if you could do it, somebody else might be able to do it as well, so you've got to keep them out, because if you control it, you control the whole ball of wax. So the Space Command becomes the military arm of corporate globalization, the new world order, if you will. I would submit to you, and if you've been watching the base closing round, I don't know if you have any base. Do you have any bases in your community that are on the list, the base closure list? Well, where I live in Maine, I'll use that for an example. We have two bases on the list. And as I've been traveling, most places I go, local governments, the state government, the senators, the congressmen, are on their knees begging the Pentagon in this base closing round, BRAC, not to close our local bases, because we depend on these bases for jobs, right? Especially at a time when jobs are moving out of this country at the pace they are. I want to give you an example. Last April, I went to Colorado Springs, Colorado, home of the Space Command. And they were having their annual Space Foundation convention. 6,500 people in attendance, military personnel, aerospace industry. They brought in 500 students from around the country to brainwash them. And 20 of us were outside holding signs and banners. One of them said, "Group Think." And while I was there, I learned that in Colorado Springs, out of a population of 357,000 people, 47% of the people in that community work for the military-industrial complex. And just last night, I learned from Martin, when we spoke together in Olympia, similar figures for this area, and I hope during the Q&A you can maybe share some of those. But all of this to me, my whole point here, is that America is addicted to militarism, to war, to violence. And we have been from the early stages of the creation of the cloth of this nation. And that I would submit to you as peace activists, we will never, ever, ever end war. We could stop the Iraq war tomorrow, but within a year we'll be back into another one, like a drunk going up to the bar who needs another drink. Because our local economies need the infusion of money to keep the production lines going, to keep building the tanks and the planes and the, you know, this and that and everything else. We are addicted to war. And we will never end warfare until we deal with one very fundamental question: jobs. Until we deal with jobs and the fact that local people increasingly in America make their living building our number one export product in America, which is weapons. And when weapons is your number one industrial export, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line? That's right, endless war, as Bush might say. I want to read to you a quote. See if you can tell me where this quote comes from, okay? It's from an American GI. You tell me when. "I really felt guilty as I applied the torch to huts that were homes of content until we ravagers came spreading desolation everywhere. Our mission here is ostensibly to destroy, but may it not transpire that we pillagers are carelessly sowing the seeds of empire." Vietnam? Anyone else?
Indian Wars.
Indian Wars. Oh, anybody else?
Philippines.
You win the prize, sir. You're the first one ever. This was a veteran of George Washington's army in 1779 as they set out to remove the Iroquois civilization from New York State. As Washington moved to push the boundaries of this new empire westward. And you know, we went to war with Canada twice, trying to take Canada. And then, fortunately, we didn't succeed. And then we went to war with Mexico, where we did succeed. And you know, it took large portions of what is now the United States of America. We took that from Mexico and then on to the Philippines and on and on and on to where we are today. Let me read you another quote, more contemporary. A year ago, July passed, July 16th, reported in Associated Press from Iraq, Captain Will Hickok VI, a relative of the famous Wild Bill Hickok, stationed in Iraq with the Army's elite 9th Cavalry Unit. And this is what he said. "This is what I like. Just scouting. Sitting out here, spying, watching out. It's relaxing. It's almost like playing cowboys and Indians." So friends, the nation's soul is addicted, and we need a healing. The natives called it the hoop. The sacred hoop, the sacred circle was broken. The white man they saw was blinded by his love for the green frog skin. His connection to the earth was broken. A spiritual disconnection to the earth was broken. So when it rained, the white man living in his four walls didn't know where the water went. He didn't follow where the water went. And he was fouling his own nest. His connection to the Mother Earth was broken. And he was living a life that would destroy the next seven generations because the decisions he took were disconnected. So how do we get out from behind this eight ball we're behind today? It's partly political, but it's partly spiritual reconnection. I want to suggest there is one thing political. I want to talk first about political and then spiritual reconnection. Political, we need to deal with jobs. We need an economic conversion campaign in the peace movement in America. We need to start talking about jobs. Yes, we need to keep protesting against the war. Of course we do. We need to say no to the war. Bring them home. But we also need a yes. What's our yes message? What's our vision? What's our positive vision? The public cries out for direction. They get no faith from the Republicans and the Democrats. The largest emerging political party in America today is the Independents, who have faith in neither party. They're looking for direction. But who's giving them a vision? Back in the 80s, we had one. We called it the peace dividend, economic conversion. Because of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, we're going to have the peace dividend. We're going to be able to take our tax dollars and do good things. We're not going to need NATO anymore and keep spending all that money on NATO. But then in a moment, it was gone. What happened to it? It was all over America, the conversion campaign, and then it was gone. You remember who was president at the time? King George I. And he had a Operation Just Cause, an invasion of Panama, to go in and get that one bad apple, Manuel Noriega. You remember that? Who had been working for the CIA since the 1950s. We had to go in and get him, and we, in the middle of the night, burned down an entire neighborhood called El Chorrillo, killing over 2,000 innocent civilian people. If that wasn't terrorism like 9/11, what is? To get that one bad apple. And then we had to go in and get the other bad apple and push Saddam Hussein, who had been working for the CIA since the 1950s. We had to get him out of Kuwait after our ambassador, April Glaspie, gave him the green light to go into Kuwait in the first place. And then the conversion movement was gone. And we were back to endless war. But now they say we're going to hit the wall real soon. Peak oil. Oil's running out. Price is going to skyrocket. We got a fossil fuel-based economy. We're going to hit the wall. Gasoline's going to be $8 to $9 a gallon. A friend of mine just came back from Holland, where she's from originally. Told me that's what they're paying in Holland now. American equivalent, $8 to $9. Home heating oil in Maine last summer was $1.40. Right now it's $2 a gallon. Next year it'll probably be $3. It's going to be soon that poor people, working class people in Maine can't afford to heat their home in the middle of dead winter. What are they going to do? They're going to turn to the government. The government's going to say, "I'm sorry, we can't help you. We got to spend our money in Iraq on the war. We got to help Halliburton and Bechtel get richer." The people are going to turn and say, "What do we do now?" And who's going to have a vision for them and an answer and a direction and a political movement. Who's going to provide that if we don't start today? And so I suggest to you that at places that are building weapons today for these endless wars, and so that we can have this number one industrial export, we need today to start talking about conversion. Why is it that with your hard-earned tax dollars, we can't build windmills at these plants? Why is it that with your tax dollars, we can't build solar and put a solar water heater on every single house and business in the United States of America? Why not? Even in Maine, solar works. Think of the jobs created in design, manufacturing, installation, repair, on every house and business in America. Millions and millions of jobs. Clean, cheap energy, getting us away from ozone depletion. Why can't we have the best public transportation rail system in the entire world? If we can send two rovers powered with plutonium to Mars that are driving around there today, then why can't we have a rail system in this country with your tax dollars? Why can't we do that? You know, up in Maine, up in the northern part of the state has just given permission to build this wind farm, a place called Mars Hill. And it's going to supply wind for 25,000 homes and businesses in the state. Clean, free energy from Mother Nature. And guess what? The windmills are not going to be made at Bath Iron Works in Maine, where they build the Aegis Destroyer, whose job it is to destroy, and that is going to be outfitted with theater missile defense systems and parked off the coast of China, in Japan, in South Korea, in Taiwan, beginning a coastal encirclement, as we already now have an inland border encirclement of China. Why can't we build those windmills at Bath Iron Works in Maine or anywhere else in this country? But you know where they're going to be built? At a converted shipyard in Copenhagen, Denmark. Because Denmark is the world's leading producer of windmills today. And by the year 2020, Denmark says they will produce over 50% of their national energy needs with wind power. Now, if they can do it, why can't we do it here in this country? And why can't we create a political demand that unites the peace movement, that unites the environmental movement, and that unites the labor unions, that it's a win-win-win all the way around? Why can't we begin to integrate our collective demand, create a national movement, and say, this is what we want. We want a yes, and we want it now. Why can't we do that? Well, let me close with the other part of the vision. I told you in the beginning that my stepfather was in the military. He was in the Air Force. He was stationed in Korea during the Korean War, and he went to Vietnam. And when he was in Vietnam, he was stationed at Da Nang Air Force Base. And at night, this base would be shelled, mortar fire, and almost every night he'd be under the bed. That was the routine, dive for under the bed. And when he came back from Vietnam, we were up at Eglin Air Force Base in the panhandle of Florida. And they have a bombing range on the base. And at night, sometimes they would bomb. And he would hear the bomb. And instinctively, muscle memory, he's under the bed. And he began to drink more and more and more to hide the demons within him. And he became an alcoholic, a severe alcoholic. And he became violent. And he began, over many years' period of time, he beat me as a child. And often, before or during or after my beating, he would say to me this, you know, this hurts me more than it hurts you. At the time, it wasn't a lot of solace, let me tell you. It didn't make me feel better. But as I got older, I began to listen to those words. Imagine generation after generation of Americans whooping the world's ass in a series of wars, not being fought because the American working class GI wanted to, but because they had to. They had been told to do so by those who ran the country. The whooping often hurt the GIs as much as it hurt those they administered it to. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, has just become known since Vietnam. In earlier wars, GIs were ridiculed when they got battle fatigue or became gun-shy. Virtually every family in America has been touched by the trauma of war. These generations of soldiers have come home, most of them never talking about their experiences, and gone on to try to put their lives back together in a country that did not want to know about how they felt. What happens to the pent-up violence inside these American GIs when they return? They feel guilt, but they are told they're heroes. So they hold the conflicted feelings inside, and they turn on their loved ones like molten volcanoes. The corporate culture does not care what they feel. The corporate culture does not want to talk about the pain and suffering of the GIs, because the corporate culture has plans for endless war to subdue the world for its benefit. After a while, this proclivity to violence turns to ugly addiction. We as a culture begin to celebrate it and brag on our prowess. We romanticize the wars and the warriors. We idolize the weapons. Today, I'm standing in your town 10 minutes after I arrived, and I hear this screeching roar, and I look up, and it's Hell's Angels above my head. I have an appointment with Hell's Angels. The Navy calls them the Blue Angels. I have an appointment with them on 9/11 weekend. They're coming to Brunswick, Maine, where I live, to perform at the Brunswick Naval Air Station. And as a veteran for peace, our organization is organizing, and I'm organizing it, a demonstration from our town center to the Navy base, where we will be carrying banners that say, "Real angels don't drop bombs." We idolize the weapons and stand in wonder as the planes fly overhead in celebration of our collective insanity. And insanity it is. If you doubt it, just ask some of those folks whose countries we have invaded. We must climb out of this deep, dark hole. In order to do so, we must first admit our addiction. And then we must get treatment for it. Just like any other addict, we must begin a collective national 12-step program to recover from our passion for war. The peace movement in America is the mirror. We hold up the mirror so the country can gaze into the glass and see what we have become. Most Americans don't want to look. They know what's in there, but if they look deeply into the mirror, then they might have to do something about it. And the reality in America is that this is one subject that we do not touch. Domestic violence is always denied by the family. I know all about that. I remember vividly the days after my mother was beaten and I had to walk to school with a heavy heart and no one to share it with. I was taught to keep it quiet, and so we do. I thank God for the peace movement. It has helped me find my way back to some semblance of sanity. It has given me a safe place where I can tell my story to people who deeply care. The peace movement is the conscience of America. We need more of it. Thank you all very much.